The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Counsell. Welcome to the program. My guest is Quinnell Merchant. He's a partner and chief operating officer at Revitate Sports. Mr. Merchant was previously managing director of Lotus Advisory, a consulting firm providing strategic advisory, project management, public affairs and communication support to clients in sports, technology, real estate, public policy, and philanthropy. He co-founded CalOZ, an advocacy group for opportunity for zone investments. He specializes in public-private partnerships, having played a central role, or central roles, I should say, in more than $8 billion in projects nationally. He was instrumental in the development of the Golden One Center. That's where the Sacramento Kings play. Revitate Sports is owner of the Sacramento Kings, or they're related to the ownership of the Sacramento Kings. Golden One Center, beautiful basketball arena. I've been there. I've been in it in downtown Sacramento. And that came into being via his roles as the mayor's chief of staff in the Sacramento Kings executive. He's also a former nonprofit executive in healthcare and education and sits on the board of the Green Sports Alliance. He earned his BA at Harvard, his MBA at Harvard, comes well-credentialed, Ivy League. Mr. Quinnell Merchant, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to join you.
Let me ask you, the mayor of Sacramento at the time, did it happen to be Kevin Johnson, former Phoenix Suns guard? Yeah, it was. Okay. And did he also play for the Kings? I forget if he played for the Sacramento Kings.
He did not. So he grew up in Sacramento. He could have been drafted by the Kings, but he was not. They picked, I think, Kenny Smith instead. And so he always had that. He won't admit it, but he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder that his hometown team didn't draft him.
Well, Kenny Smith did pretty well. He's still doing well. Yeah. Kenny the Jet Smith on TNT is his gig. There with Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal and so on. Mm-hmm. So your bio reads like you were the mayor's chief of staff and a Sacramento Kings executive simultaneously, but those were separate, correct?
Yeah. So, you know, I come to sports and I come to investing from a non-traditional background, but economics MBA by training, but I had been in the nonprofit sector and then in public service before. And it was during my tenure as the mayor's chief of staff that the Sacramento Kings previous ownership, the Maloof family, started looking at trying to move the team out of Sacramento. And the Kings to Sacramento are like the Packers to Green Bay. It's a really tight connection. And so first from the mayor's office was all the effort to try to keep the team in Sacramento, develop the plan for a new arena and recruit a new investor group to buy the team. And then once we consummated that transaction, we were able to keep the team, get an arena plan and get a new ownership group approved by the NBA. I moved from City Hall to the Sacramento Kings and was able to sort of help build that arena and get it built and brought to life and learn a lot about sports. And then since there, I've had a really interesting career kind of at the intersection of sports and real estate and investing.
Now, clarify this for me. Raj Sports is the owner of the Sacramento Kings and the Portland Thorns women's pro soccer team. So what's the relationship? Then the family is the Bothells. It's the Bothell family.
Bothell.
Yeah. Raj Sports. And then what's Revitate's relationship to Raj Sports?
Yeah. So the key connector to all this is the Bothell family. This is a family office that's based in Newport Beach, and they've been in business for about six decades, kind of American dream story. Raj Bothell, the patriarch, came from India as a young student, fell in love with his future wife in California, built an amazing business in the apparel industry. And both he and his wife, and then ultimately the kids, Alex and Lisa, built a really successful business in the apparel industry, sold it to private equity in one of the largest transactions in the industry's history, built a family office, and have sort of diversified since then. And throughout all of that journey, this incredible passion for sports, the mom, Marta, was an athlete. Raj was active and both the kids were athletic too. And so they were owners of a World League of American football team in the 90s. And then I got to know them about 10 years ago when They were handpicked by the commissioner of the NBA at the time, David Stern, to be recommended as part of the new investor group for the Sacramento Kings. So they joined as a family in the, to become principal co-owners of the Sacramento Kings. And we've collaborated over 10 years. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, they started thinking about broadening beyond just family office investments to take outside capital. And they've now built out this investment platform called Revitate, which I run as a partner and COO. And so the family is investing both through the family office. That's their position in the Kings. And we just recently acquired the Portland Thorns of the National Women's Soccer League, which we're super excited about. And then the Revitate platform is also raising capital and will be raising capital for sports investment strategies as part of this sort of really interesting emerging trend in sports private equity.
Now, Revitate is an alternative assets firm, correct? A private equity
Correct.
firm. You guys acquire sports entities, franchises, but are you in other fields as well, or is it strictly, do you focus strictly on sports?
No, we have three verticals. We have sports, we have consumer brands, and we have real estate. So sports is really about team ownership positions, sports anchored real estate, and then sort of emerging sports business models and sort of the ecosystem of sports and entertainment. But we also do consumer brands. The family, obviously having a history in the apparel industry, has a lot of expertise on the sort of B2C direct to consumer brands. And then we also have strategies in real estate around opportunity zones, as well as multifamily workforce housing.
All of this plays together then. Sports, you build real estate around sports arenas. There's merchandising in sports. That's big money. It all makes sense. Those three verticals that you mentioned. So, we're here to talk about the investment opportunities in sports. I mean, we see owners buy franchises. Some of these franchises don't even perform very well. They can turn around and sell it in 10 years, 15, 20 years, at, pay $1 billion, sell it for $5 billion. I mean, it's some incredible, appreciation on the their investments. As you look around, when it comes to high net worth individuals, high net worth and ultra high net worth families that are looking to diversify, they like sports. They see Jerry Jones on the sidelines making a big to-do about his ownership of the team. They saw Jerry Buss, the late Jerry Buss, bring the Lakers to, and all the celebrities in the audience is a very sexy business. So if they're interested in getting involved, not necessarily at that level, that takes a tremendous amount of money or a big partnership. But not everything costs what the NFL or NBA or Major League Baseball costs. What are the investment opportunities in sports these days? Can you kind of give us an overview of where you think some of these sweet spots are?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a couple of things. I think first, the nature of sports ownership is changing. We're in the early stages of a really interesting paradigm shift. So the models that you spoke of with Jerry Jones and some of these other sort of single individuals, single families in these control positions, sometimes owning the entire team, sometimes owning the majority, that was kind of the 1.0 or maybe 2.0 version of sports ownership. You live in a certain market, you become kind of a respected civic leader, and then owning a sports team is an extension of some portfolio of activities you have in that specific place. And there's been an evolution now in terms of who's getting involved in sports, driven by any number of factors. But now you're seeing a much broader and more diverse group of people looking at sports ownership. And so, to your point, at the highest levels, and the NFL just exists in a different stratosphere than all the other leagues on many dimensions, certainly in terms of the valuations and the economics. There are rare opportunities to have sports ownership. It's extremely expensive, and there's just not a lot of people who have the capital or the interest to take on those positions. But downstream of that, there's tremendous opportunity, and so you kind of can bifurcate it in a couple ways. There's obviously the NFL. You have other major kind of blue chip leagues like the NBA, Major League Baseball, National Hockey League, and increasingly Major League Soccer, where the price points are certainly lower than the NFL. They're still pretty substantial. The Phoenix Suns just traded at $4 billion last year, which was a very significant record price for that team. So it's still a high buy-in, but there's perhaps a little bit more affordability for folks at that level. Then beyond those, at least the North American sports ecosystem, there's a lot of really interesting opportunities. So we've been really excited and focused on women's sports in particular. We just acquired the Portland Thorns, which is one of the top national women's soccer league teams. And there's a number of reasons to do that, but we can get into it in more detail if you'd like. But there's tremendous tailwinds, a lot of growth trends that are exciting if you like sports, and they're exciting if you like investors. There's Formula One, there's other emerging leagues. Depending on your risk appetite, you can try to make a bet on a pickleball league or the drone racing league or any number of things. There's a whole variety of sports leagues out there, and it's attracting a broader and more diverse set of investors than historically has been the case.
Well, and Tom Brady just invested in pickleball, right?
I believe so,
He bought a franchise, or he's invested in it anyway. Women's sports are really seeming to emerge big time now. And you see Caitlin Clark, who just broke Pete Maravich's college scoring record. She's drawn so much attention, and is going to draw more attention to WNBA when she signs with one of those franchises. And WNBA already seems to have quite a bit of momentum. So it would seem that investing in the women's side of the gender equation is a good opportunity. It's going to expand the overall audience, I would imagine. I mean, obviously, women are sports fans. You see, they love the NFL games. You see them at NBA games and so on. But this is, I think, it's an opportunity to pull a lot more women into it based on what we're seeing. So along those lines, when it comes to emerging sports, because it's not like it used to be where we had the big four, NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, NBA, I left one of them out, but the big four, hockey, basketball, baseball, football. But now we're seeing all these other sports emerging. What talk a little bit about that and the opportunities they present.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the nature of what it means to be a sports team is evolving, and the number of leagues and the number of entertainment options is evolving. So women's sports is a huge category that we're very bullish on. WNBA, NWSL, you look at increased coverage of, NCAA, Final Four basketball, March Madness, tennis players, gymnastics, et cetera. And it's driven, by any number of trends. So we think that's a really interesting growth space. There's sort of secondary leagues. So, there's the United Soccer League, which is the Division II soccer league, men's professional soccer league. They're coming online. They've been expanding significantly over a period of time. Minor league baseball definitely had some headwinds during COVID, but that remains an interesting opportunity for investors. And there's all sorts of league startups. It seems like every 2 or 3 years, there's another attempt to try to create a spring football league. Like I said, there's drone racing leagues and pickleball, and don't forget things like Formula One racing, which is also attracting attention. And then European sports have been attracting a lot of investor attention too. So I think there's a recognition that one, people love sports and entertainment, and that demand is pretty inelastic. We saw even during the pandemic, when they stopped playing games or they got delayed in certain ways, or you couldn't go to a game, that the appetite remained high. So that's significant. And then two, these are becoming increasingly professionalized businesses that maybe a 1.0 version of a sports team was just, the players and the coaches and maybe the venue and the fans and some sponsors. But now you have these sports enterprises really diversify into platforms with real estate, with technology, with media, with globalization, with gaming and fantasy and gambling now. There's just really interesting diversified businesses. And for all those reasons, people are, I think, are attracted to sports. And I think the last part of it too is just it's an attention economy moment. And it's very rare now where we get a critical mass of people to all be looking at the same thing at the same time, without, DVRing it or time shifting it. And sports as live entertainment remains really, really attractive to streamers and other media companies because it brings this really interesting cross-section of people together in rare moments where we're all watching the same thing for a couple hours across demographics, across different geographies, in an increasingly scarce way that I think also makes sports really attractive.
Yeah, that's a good point because the whole kind of mass experience of watching, say, All in the Family or MASH or other TV shows, that just doesn't exist anymore. But sports is almost the last refuge of the whole nation coming together to watch the Super Bowl or the champion, the March Madness championship game, these sorts of things. Or the women's talk about a real accelerant to women's sports, the women's USA women's soccer team winning World Cups and so on, just bringing lots of attention to it. How important is a winning record for a franchise because, you know, you look at the New York Giants, they stunk for years before they got good and won some Super Bowls. And a lot of people, you know, I'm from upstate New York, so there was a lot of chatter about the New York Giants, of course. And there were people who said, you know, they don't want a winning team. Then you have to pay players on winning teams. They're going to pay more money and they sell out regardless of their 2-14 or 16-0. But that's not the case. And there's a lot of cities where we see a team that's doing poorly and the stands start to empty out. So how important is the is it if you're going to be financially successful having a winning team?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the answer is it depends on the sport and it depends on the market. So there's oversimplified, there's kind of two types of sports leagues. There's the sports leagues where the media rights deals are so good that you could probably even make money if the stadium was empty. And the NFL, for example, I don't know if that's literally true, but they have such a lucrative media rights package that the team's pro rata share of that is so significant that it typically covers player salaries and probably some other expenses, where the risk of the team-specific operations, whether it's ability to get fans and sponsors engaged or the win-loss record, it's important, but you're still going to be okay as a business with or without it, which is why you see what you're talking about, which is you can be a really successful NFL team or not a successful NFL team on the field and still have a lot of business value. It's because they have those big media rights contracts that really protect against the risk of, operations or win-loss. That's not the case for a lot of other sports, though. And especially if you go downstream beyond the NFL and NBA, MLB, MLS, which has had seen tremendous growth and had a really interesting media rights deal executed recently, is still more event day driven. So there's the folks like the NFL, maybe NBA, MLB, who can do well on the basis of those media rights deal, but the vast majority of leagues and teams still have to execute in their market. They still have to try hard to deliver a good product for fans and sponsors to try to win games because their revenues are so much more tied to event day, the games and the stadiums and the arenas and all that. So it kind of depends. And the only exception to that are these markets where the fans are just incredibly loyal. So I remember my days in Sacramento. We used to talk about a statistic where they were number one. They had the lo two of the longest sellout streaks in NBA history. But during that period of time, they only made the playoffs about 9, 10, or 11 times out of 26 years. So these fans were there, rain or shine, win or lose. And that speaks to the ability of a team to develop a relationship and a connection with the community that transcends this year's win-loss record. It is about something bigger. So it sometimes it matters, it sometimes doesn't it matter. But for the vast majority of teams, you still want to be out there trying your best to win games. And that's what fans expect, and that's what owners should be focused on.
Yeah, and it's very much a star system in these leagues. I mean, you need star players to sell merchandise because it's not like just your own fans will buy. They'll buy across markets. So there's the merchandising aspect of this. Let's talk about the revenue stream. So you've got the fan attendance, you've got parking and concession sales, you have merchandising, buying, Dak Prescott's jersey or what have you. What are some of the television contract you mentioned, or media contract, which is huge. What are some of the other revenue streams beyond that? What am I leaving out?
Yeah, I mean you hit the key ones. So, again, for the big leagues, that media rights deal is on a, on a proportion basis incredibly significant. The TV deals, sometimes the regional deals, the national TV deals, the regional TV deals, to the extent that's still a thing, all of that's really critical. But when I talk about the event day, I'm talking about, ticket sales, which is season ticket sales, partial season ticket sales, group sales, individual ticket sales. It's about sponsorships, the naming rights, the jersey sponsorships, as well as, the signage, the digital, all that sort of stuff. You talked about merchandising, concessions. Those are important. They tend to be a little bit lower in importance than those key sales and marketing ones, but those are the big ones. But I think, the event day suite revenues, all that's really important as well. Where you're seeing some really interesting innovation is finding new revenue streams outside of the media rights deals and outside of those event day revenues. So that's where like the real estate plays, where you not only build an arena, but you build this, ancillary district that has retail and office and hospitality and residential, that creates additional streams of revenue to the parent company. That's become a really successful pattern that you see around the country. You see people doing leveraging their really loyal fan base into mobile apps and digital tech, and this, the Kings are very innovative in that and have an esports team and NBA 2K and all sorts of things going to try to monetize. The NFL has been incredibly effective with fantasy football, creating deeper engagement and affinity and all the ancillary business models that come off of that. And now with gambling and et cetera, et cetera. There's been a proliferation of these additional revenue streams outside of the core ones that we traditionally think about, that's providing even more economic opportunity and value in sports.
Fantasy football is a phenomenon. I mean, I've got friends who I'll say, "How's your fantasy football?" I've never done it myself, but how's your fantasy football team doing? And it's like, well, which one? I'm in three different leagues.
That's
They play
right.
and they're very, and then on Sunday when I'm talking football with them, they're not talking about whether their team is winning or not. They're talking about how individual players are performing because that they're more concerned about that because they're the players on their fantasy football team.
Yeah, it's incredible. First of all, I highly recommend you stay out of fantasy football because your personal life will suffer from it. You go from caring about maybe your team. I'm surprised you're not a Bills fan. I assumed you'd be a Bills fan based on where you said you're from. But you stop caring just about your team, and then you're like looking at the place kicker for like the 2 in 10 team because he's on your team, and is he going to hit this extra point so you can win it? I mean, it's entertaining for the folks who do it. It can be addictive. It can be problematic because you're spending way too much time on a Wednesday or Thursday looking at the waiver wire. But from a business perspective, it's absolutely brilliant for these leagues because it just heightens the level of engagement for fans, and then they're consuming more of the content, right? Because now you're not only focused on just your team, you're focused on players that exist on other teams. And candidly, there's some people who don't even, follow one team anymore. To your point, they really are more interested in a player here or there or things like that. So it's just another example of how this is just a really fertile ecosystem, and there's so many different directions to create value and innovation and entertainment for folks that are interested.
Yeah, that's what I've kind of evolved to, although not because of fantasy football, but I'm a fan of the sport. So I don't have necessarily a favorite football team or basketball team. I look at the matchups. And if there's a great matchup, I watch it. If it's a couple stinkers, I'm really not interested in watching the game. To me, it's all about the matchups. Let me ask you about these television contracts. So, one of the things I notice here, the LA Lakers are a fairly mediocre team this season, but they're on television all the time. Okay, so what is there anything in the contract, or is it that there's LeBron James there? Then people are they the ratings get better when the Lakers are on? What is it about a team like the Lakers, which is about, I think they're about a 500 record this season, but they're on television all the time? Why is that?
So first of all, let me confess my bias as both a native Denver Nuggets fan and as an adopted Sacramento Kings fan. Those are both teams that have a rivalry with the Lakers. So disclosure if you feel bias in any of my comments. But the reality is it's the market size. This is the second largest media market in the entire country, and it's one of the most successful, historically successful teams in the market. And so, media companies, TV companies, they're still businesses too, and they're trying to drive ratings. So stories about LeBron James, stories about the Los Angeles Lakers, games involving the Los Angeles Lakers are likely to drive higher viewership, higher ad spend, et cetera. So they tend to be more attractive. And that's not always the case, not to pick on them, but the New York Knicks, is the largest media market in the country. But you haven't seen them necessarily on TV quite as often because the team has sort of struggled to be relevant until the last couple of years. And so it doesn't always apply, but there are certain teams, the Dallas Cowboys, the Los Angeles Lakers, the Yankees. These are just major brands that have huge national, if not global, fan bases. And so they kind of get outsized attention. It's super irritating if you're not a fan of those teams because you kind of feel like, hey, these guys are getting a lot more heat and light than they deserve sometimes, but it's just driven by, the fan base, the opportunities for economics for the folks involved.
So let's say some of our listeners invest in the San Antonio Spurs. a great franchise yesteryear. You know, they won championships, but they stink now. Do they get the same portion of their television contract as the Lakers do? Did the league play it that way, or is it divided up based on the number of telecasts, or is everybody given the same
Great question.
Denomination?
So it varies by league, and what you're getting at is a really key component of just the governance and design of sports leagues, which is how much of a level playing field do they really create? And I have to give a lot of credit to the NBA in particular for doing a pretty good job at driving parity and you know, quality across big and small markets alike. You remember my experience was in Sacramento, where the team was, you know, considering moving to Seattle, which is a much bigger market with a lot more Fortune 500 companies in Sacramento. And so we had to really make the case for why to stay in Sacramento. And we did it. And the league was on board because they think about market dynamism and not just market size. So when you're the Sacramento Kings in Sacramento, you're basically the main, if not only, game in town. It's the only major top four pro sports league there. There's some minor league sports, but there's no football, there's no baseball, there's no hockey, etc. This is the big game in town. And so your share of the local attention around sports entertainment is enormous. And the same thing is true in San Antonio. The San Antonio Spurs are the biggest game in town. It's not even close. And so smart leagues understand market dynamism is just as important as market share. And so, or market size, I should say. And so from the NBA in particular, they have done a great job of nurturing the smaller markets because they understand the long-term value of having Indianapolis fans and San Antonio fans and Sacramento fans be just as engaged as the bigger markets. But it's all about how you design it. So to answer your question, as far as I understand, you know, yes, revenue is shared equally across the teams on these deals, which can be frustrating sometimes to the big city folks who feel like they're, hey, wait a minute, we're pulling more weight on this thing. But on the long-term good of the league, they decide, you know, we're stronger if each of us is sharing co-equally in this. And so, yes, the NBA is one of the leagues that does do that. And I think it pays off. If you look at the standings right now, I think Oklahoma City, Minnesota, Denver are the top three in the West. And if you look at the East, you know, some of the top teams are also smaller markets. But in the long run, you're building this really good ecosystem where they're viable both on the court and on a business side as well.
Yeah, I remember the days when it was like, look, all the big markets compete and all the small markets or medium sized markets are basically out. And that has changed. That's definitely changed. I mean, for San Antonio, small market, and they won championships. And I'm sure they're going to be back again someday. Sacramento is not that big a market, but the Kings are back to being a great team. So there's that. Let me ask you about sports ownership and how it's evolving. And just to front load this question a little bit, David Rubenstein, I heard him on CNBC. This was probably 2 years ago. And he said, what you're going to see happen is corporations are going to create sports ownership platforms and they're going to own multiple franchises. Do you see it happening that way? Or do you see a kind of a different evolution going on?
Oh, absolutely. It's already happening. I mean, there's already several folks. I mean, Harris Blitzer is one group that owns the New Jersey Devils, the Philadelphia 76ers. They own Blitzer owns a MLS team and a women's soccer team. And Josh Harris just bought the Washington Commanders. There's that model. And there's three or four or five or six of these already where folks are acquiring multiple sports assets across multiple leagues and now multiple continents. With an idea that there's some economies of scale, you know, in terms of strategy, in terms of leadership, in terms of execution, you can kind of argue that's what we're trying to do here at Revitate in the acquisition of multiple, you know, sports assets is that a shared, you know, governance, shared strategy, shared vision, shared expertise on how to run and operate these can be applied across multiple sports teams. So I absolutely agree that you'll see more and more entities popping up that do that. And there's some folks who do it in a distributed way across geographies and leagues. It's also common for, you know, one entity to own multiple sports teams in a given market. I think that's what they do in Toronto. They do that in Colorado, where the Cronkies own many things, but including the Nuggets of the NBA and the Avalanche of the National Hockey League, as well as the local soccer team, and I think even the lacrosse team. So there's definitely some consolidation, some economies of scale opportunities there. And there's a lot of different models that people are exploring on how to do that.
I mentioned the I used the phrase star system earlier. Let me ask you about that. We can go all the way back to Babe Ruth, and Yankee Stadium is called the house that Ruth built because he started the first player really hit home runs and numbers. Fans are coming out to see this guy smash him over the fence, and they had to build a bigger stadium. And then you look at the NBA when Magic Johnson and Larry Bird came into the league, and that rivalry just really resuscitated the NBA. Then along comes Michael Jordan. So it seems that these leagues, as big as they are, as much as many different components as there are to them, it can really boil down to a couple star players who bring a lot more interest to the sport. What does that tell you about sports leagues and maybe sports management?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I used to teach a class up in San Francisco on the sort of business and politics of sports. And my first class was that the number one concept in sports is the idea of scarcity. Scarcity drives all of the value. Scarcity of talent, which is what you're talking to, scarcity of opportunities to acquire a team, scarcity of teams. There's only 32, there's actually maybe 28 or 29 cities in the entire world that get to be NBA cities. Right, that the scarcity of this really coveted energy that we think about sports is really what drives value. And the most prominent one is just the elite quality of athletes. There's, LeBron James, who you mentioned, he's a generational talent. There was only one of him produced in his generation. The Spurs, who you just mentioned, are hoping they have a generational talent in Victor Wembanyama, who just got drafted by the team this year. So you're absolutely right that stars, no, not unlike movies, right? Having bankable, reliable movie stars returns, higher likelihood of movies doing well. So that's absolutely a component of it, but it's not always the case. You can look at collegiate sports, right? You can look at college football teams, for example, where especially now with folks not typically doing a full 4 years, you have a lot of one and dones in college basketball and college football. So the athletes are only there for relatively short periods of time, but the affinity is really more towards the brand. I'm a fan of Kentucky or Duke or Alabama or whatever that is. And so there are other models where you try to develop the affinity and the love with the institution, with the team, so that you're a little bit protected by one particular player rising or falling. But there's no doubt that at the absolute ultra elite levels, the Patrick Mahomeses, the Tom Bradys, the Michael Jordans, the LeBron James, that's just a transcendent force. And the minute that player is present or not present, it drives a lot of value. But you can still build successful models if you can, build a story and build a strategy that is bigger than just one player.
So the National Football League, I think it's fair to say the NFL has become the new national pastime. It's been the national pastime for a while. It's usurped baseball. What does the NFL do that other sports leagues can emulate and capitalize on? Do you see some things that they're doing that other leagues aren't doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think they deserve a tremendous amount of credit for what they've built over decades. I think being on a reliable period of time, like it's, Sunday afternoons, although they are changing that now and doing more games, but it's just incredibly consistently compelling television. I think something like 90 plus of the 100 top t rated TV shows this year were NFL games, and the Super Bowl was the first or second highest rated, and it was an incredibly entertaining game. That went now into overtime. And so the player stories are compelling and the action is compelling. So they just have an entertaining product. And then I think the scarcity of it. There's not that many teams. There's only so many games per season. All of this energy around fantasy and all the community building aspects of it are really relevant. But candidly, the NFL is just, if you look at any graph that has lines and X and Y axes and lines, the NFL is just always just so far ahead on everything. I don't know if it's a realistic comp for all of the other leagues. I think there's actually a lot of really interesting innovation in the NBA, in someone in the NHL and other leagues too that everybody can emulate. But it's really, I think the biggest thing is just learning to grow and evolve and adapt to your evolving consumer base. So you were talking about how you are more intrigued by specific matchups or maybe even specific players, which is actually a fairly common phenomenon among younger folks who are not as loyal to a specific jersey and a specific team, but they follow specific players. And so, fantasy is a great way to follow those players, but there's other models out there that I think that the mindset of league owners and team owners and investors now is to be really attentive to how people are choosing to engage in sports and entertainment and in life, and try to build business models that are responsive to that.
I'm glad you mentioned young people and kind of these changing psychographics, because one of the other things among young people that I've heard is they're less interested in spectating, more interested in doing. So they don't just want to watch the game; they want to be playing, Madden, Madden NFL football. So they're calling plays at the same time. They want to make decisions. They want to be the coach. Now that is done in tandem with a game, but it seems that it might be a threat that young people aren't so much wanting to sit there and stare. They want to actually, no, I'll do this myself. I want to play myself. You have esports, which you had brought up earlier, opportunities to play rather than spectate. Is you seen any impact? Is it putting a dent at all in spectator sports?
I think some of the leagues are worried about it, right? So I think baseball, for example, Major League Baseball is seeing year after year, its fan base is aging. And it seems like, I think one year the median age of a baseball fan was 56 years, and then the next year was 57, and then 58. So I think that's one sport which is obviously, it was the national pastime for a very long period of time and still has enormous following. But that's an example of a league that really is trying to figure out ways to become to stay relevant and stay engaging to a younger demographic, which is difficult when so much of baseball is tethered to this sense of tradition and consistency across time. You think about all the statistics and all of the rules that are very hard to change, just given people's love of those traditions. So I think that's an example of a sport that's in the process of trying to figure out some ways to innovate to stay relevant and stay appealing to emerging demographics. I think in other instances, it's just about finding it, being open-minded to the ways that people are going to choose to consume your sport. So one thing the NFL, for example, has done is you've seen this, is there's sort of the main broadcast, which is the traditional one that you and I probably, if we've watched games over the last several decades, is used to, where there's basically the main camera, additional cameras, two announcers, maybe three, sideline reporter, and you're sort of following in a linear way. This, but now there's additional channels where, like, Peyton and Eli Manning are providing commentary that's not literally tracking every play, but it's their observations. Nickelodeon does a more kid-oriented one with animations and all that. And what I think you're going to see over the next several years is there'll be six or seven different ways to watch the same game, and it'll appeal to people who are trying to consume that content in different ways. So technology always seems like a threat initially, and then smart innovators figure out a way to make it 1 + 1 = 5. And I think the savvier leagues are going to continue to find ways, like, okay, maybe we used to have everybody watching this one way of content, but let's now have six different ways. And maybe it's not 1/6 is watching each way. Maybe it's a little bit more, maybe it's a little bit less, but we'll continue to have differentiated, interesting content in ways that'll grow revenue and grow share over time. And I think leagues like the NBA in particular, and others are well positioned to be innovative in that way.
Yeah, NFL Red Zone, which really just
It's a great
watches teams
example.
in the red zone, and it's consistent with how young people are using social media. They don't even watch television shows; they watch social media clips from the show. So
Correct,
it's I'm going to get
correct.
the best from SNL. I don't have to sit and watch an hour. I'm going to get all the best clips, and that's it. So why do I have to watch every NFL play? Just show me what's happening in the red zone where the real money plays happen. Other than a spectacular punt return or a bomb that's completed, and so on. Let me ask you about the Sacramento Kings. They would have a championship potentially under their belt if Vlade Divac had just slapped that ball a little to the left or right instead of right into the hands of Robert Horry at the Lakers. I cannot tell you how that ripped my heart. I'm not a Laker fan. Let me tell you, I don't pull for the Lakers. And they finally looked like they were going to go to the NBA Finals and maybe win a championship. And Robert Horry just nails it. And wow. That was just unbelievable. The Kings went into a lull for some years after that, not immediately after that, but and now they're a good team again. When are they going to win an NBA championship? How are you feeling about their prospects? It feels like they're one really good player away from doing it.
Yeah, so first of all, that is a you're describing one of the darkest days in the history of the city of Sacramento.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I, just to defend Vlade, who is a friend and a good guy, he did make the right basketball play. It just so happened that one of the most clutch human beings to ever hold a basketball in high pressure situations was perfectly placed. So that was
Yes.
a tough one, but he did make the correct basketball play at the time. But look, there's a lot of excitement in Sacramento right now about the current team. There's definitely a lot more people closer to the action than me, but to win an NBA title is incredibly difficult. And you were talking about the star system. This is true across many sports. I mean, there was a time I think where Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Patrick Mahomes, and like two other people had been in like 20, 18 of the last 20 Super Bowls or something like that. I mean, it's a really high barrier to get to that highest level. And the NBA, it's exceptionally tough too. And then to compound that by being a smaller market that's not able to just attract players on the basis of location, you got to be really good at drafting and developing and scouting and free agency. And after many years of trying and not doing so well, this latest version of the team has a really good nucleus, a couple core stars, and a third guy, Keegan Murray, who's in his second year but is showing a lot of potential, and they're all very young. And so, I think patience is the key. But yeah, you got to have a little bit of luck, but you have to get that tenacity. But every rung on the ladder gets a little bit further away than the last one. So now, after many years of not being there, the team is consistently in the playoffs, and now you got to build from there. So I think it's possible over the next couple of years. There's certainly the talent to do it.
Oh, there you go. I appreciate you coming on the program because you not only gave our listeners insights into investment opportunities, but also just a better understanding of how these leagues operate and where the and the most important components to what they do and where things are trending. So for our listeners, again, our guest has been Kunal Merchant, COO and partner of Revitate Sports. Kunal, thank you for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.